Welcome back to Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. That's the sound of what's known as a British brass band. It is a particular type of sound that was born in the mining towns of England in the early 19th century. The style is still popular all over the world, with many hundreds of bands in existence in the UK, Europe, and the United States.
Milwaukee has its own nationally recognized version of that kind of band, the Milwaukee Festival Brass. They'll have their annual holiday concert tomorrow evening at Pius 11 High School, featuring some arrangements of Christmas music by Andrew Wainwright, who joins me in the studio now, along with Mark Taylor, who is the director of the Milwaukee Festival Brass. Gentlemen, welcome to Lake Effect.
Thank you.
Let us start with the history of brass bands. My understanding, Andrew, is that they began in the UK.
Yes.
and that they were really a way to kind of keep workers from raising trouble.
That's right. It started with miners, I think, and the miners lived near the pits, and it gave them something to do when they weren't working.
So they wouldn't agitate for rights and that sort of
That's
thing?
That's pretty much
Was
it.
That the idea?
Yeah.
Brass bands evolve in the Industrial Revolution for two reasons, one of which is the social conditions that Andrew mentioned. The other is that the technology for the manufacture of brass instruments becomes significantly better in the middle of the 19th century than had previously been known. We see this in the music of the classical era and earlier composers, Mozart and so forth, who don't really trust the brass instruments well enough to give them a melody. Brass instruments are mostly used to punctuate the music or to provide extra body to the sound of the ensemble. But it's during the Industrial Revolution that the quality of engineering, the reliability of the instruments drastically improves, and the cost comes down. So sponsors such as a coal mine or even a community would raise the funds to purchase a set of brass instruments, sometimes enough to outfit an entire band, hire a tutor or a leader to instruct the players, sometimes give them fancy dress costumes and even a room or a building where they could rehearse and socialize, and then would encourage them to give concerts. And the most economical place for them to give a concert was, of course, outdoors. And then they didn't have to build a concert hall, and you could have as many people as you wanted. So brass was the natural choice of instrumentation for that, since the sound of brass instruments carries better outdoors than woodwinds do.
Did the Industrial Revolution also play a part in terms of getting valves on these instruments? Because a lot of the earlier instruments were all done by lip. It was natural horns, natural trumpets.
Yeah, the valve technology that comes about in the early 19th century plays a big part in the improved reliability of brass instruments and the improved intonation quality of the instrument.
Right. You weren't depending on your lip quite so much.
Exactly. And, right. And you could play a complete chromatic scale. You could get all 12 notes of the scale as opposed to whatever that piping was designed to play.
Andrew, how did you get involved? Were you a player first before you got involved in writing and arranging for brass bands?
Yeah, my musical background comes from the Salvation Army, actually. I grew up in the Salvation Army. My parents are Salvation Army officers or pastors. And so music was always around the home. And one of the first things I ever wanted to do was play a brass instrument because my father played and we had a lot of recordings going on in the car or around the home. So it wasn't until I was about 12 years old that I penned my first piece. But I started playing the cornet at about age 9. So that's where it all began.
And do you still play? Or
I do. I migrated down the band to the euphonium, which is a much bigger instrument.
I was going to say, you went from almost the smallest to just
about
the largest. I did,
via the alto horn for a few years.
Tell me what makes up a typical brass band, which would be, and I think a lot of us here in the United States think of Salvation Army as the brass band, the kind of brass bands.
Yep.
And this is opposed to, say, a concert band, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's important to say right out, I think, that today in this country, in the 21st century, the term brass band actually has a very nonspecific meaning. There are lots of different kinds of ensembles that can be considered a brass band. right here in Milwaukee, people are probably familiar with the Extra Crispy Brass Band, which is a New Orleans-style brass band. Then you also have groups like the First Brigade Band of Wisconsin, which is a historical reenactment, Civil Era type of brass band. But our bands, the Salvation Army bands and the traditional British style bands, come right out of that British tradition. Normally constructed of approximately 28 brass players, give or take a few, and a handful, maybe three or four percussionists, also providing extra color in the ensemble.
Okay, so we're talking cornets and trumpets, both?
No trumpets. Only cornets.
Okay, yeah. Interesting. And then, so what are the middle instruments, and obviously tubas and things at the bottom?
Yes, you've got the outer horns below the cornets. You also have the flugelhorn, which gives a bit more color to the horn section. You have the baritone, which is a bit bigger than the outer horn, looks similar, but just a bit bigger. Then euphonium, you've got your trombones, all in that kind of range in the middle band.
And we're talking like bass drum, snare drum type of things?
Well, it's interesting because I am a percussionist, and it's interesting the role that percussion plays. For much of the history of brass bands, percussion was, I think we could charitably call it sort of an afterthought.
The unwanted stepchild
of
brass bands.
Well, a little bit. Well, percussion equipment was difficult to obtain and hard to find people to play it. So composers, if they wrote music for the percussionists, it was semi-optional. If you left it out, the piece would work without it. But in the last 40 to 50 years, composers have really written a lot more adventurous and idiomatic music for percussion, and most bands now have a sizable inventory of instruments to choose from.
And people to play them.
It's actually quite rewarding now for percussionists to be members of a brass band, even if the name of the ensemble doesn't reflect your talents.
You just said something that I find really interesting in that the last 40 or 50 years, and I think a lot of people might think of brass bands as something that's antiquated, and we're talking about repertoire that is older, but this obviously is not the case, that there's active composition going on for the brass
band.
Yeah.
There's a lot of contemporary compositions being written at the moment, and also, there's a lot of young people playing in bands. I mean, from my experience of the UK, if you look at even the top bands, many of them come through the music colleges as students still in their teens, and really a diverse age range, right from teens up to people, retirees, you know.
So what do you think makes it so popular, as opposed to going the orchestral route or the concert band route? What is it about this? And I'm assuming that there are professional bands, that this is not just an amateur thing the way it was.
I don't believe there are any professional bands. Even the very top bands, some of them might pay the players, but technically they're amateur bands.
And the reason for that is the contesting history. Contests were a big part of the establishment of brass bands, especially earlier in their history. And to make it fair, there's a very elaborate rules structure about how bands can compete against one another. So it's not allowed to pay the players in the UK. In this country, we do have a few professional brass bands, such as the River City Brass Band in Pittsburgh or the Brass Band of Battle Creek in Michigan, but those are pretty rare exceptions. Mostly brass bands are community endeavors with amateur players, but I think what's remarkable about brass bands is that in the world of community-based music making, brass bands have achieved an enormously high level of musicianship. That's why you see composers gravitating towards this style, even today, to write pieces for the band to play.
So how does the Milwaukee Band fit in to this, and how long has it been around?
Milwaukee Festival of Brass was started in 1985, so this is our 30th season. It was founded in the British brass band tradition. British-style brass bands actually almost entirely disappeared from American culture in the 20th century. The Salvation Army, in fact, was the only really continuous thread of brass band style for much of that time. But in the 1980s, a man by the name of J. Perry Watson founded an organization, the North American Brass Band Association, to try to encourage interest and activity in this style once again. Bands were formed around the country, and they come together still today for an annual festival. And it was during that time that the Milwaukee Festival of Brass was founded.
Are there still contests in this country? There are in Britain, right?
Yeah, very much so. It's quite a big thing there. Contests are really taking off here. You have the NABBA contest and the US Open, which are the two biggest contests that happen each year. And an increasing number of bands are taking part in those contests. But in the UK, some bands can be playing up to 5 or 6 contests a year, and it's a really big, big part of what they do, as well as the big concert program that they have year to year.
That's a lot of time.
It is a lot of time. And some bands question the sensibility of devoting that much time to competition. You know, there are people who say, you know, music is an art form. It doesn't necessarily need to be better than someone else. But I think you can't argue the fact that the existence of contesting and the popularity of it in the UK has led to the such significant advancement in technique and musical expression of the players.
Would you say that it's kept it alive as well?
Very much that. People say it's kind of the lifeblood of the movement, almost a necessary evil at times. But it keeps standards up. It keeps the interest. And a lot of these contests sell out. You know, they're selling out the Royal Albert Hall, 4,000 or 5,000 people. And there's also a big European tradition now. The European Brass Band Championships increasing in size every year and popularity. And the standard really is incredible. Like, you're talking professional level now, almost at the level of the real top orchestras.
In fact, if I might add, it's even the case that many of the brass players in the top orchestras in the UK come from a brass banding tradition in their upbringing. And so it's very much seen as a great way for brass players to develop fluency and technique in their playing.
Now, obviously, Andrew, you're from the UK. Mm-hmm. Mark, you're from here, or at least from the United States,
yes,
if not from Milwaukee. How different are the American and the British traditions? I mean, is the Milwaukee Festival of Brass strictly in the British tradition, or is there an American influence that has seeped in? And if so, what is it?
I think it's very interesting to observe the evolution of brass bands in this country over the last, say, 30 years. Because I think that the bands in this country have a great deal of respect for the heritage and tradition of the British style that we've been handed. Much of the repertoire and much of our concept of sound comes out of that tradition. At the same time, there's a wealth of American music that is just begging to be played by this wonderful ensemble sound. And so you will see that a lot of American brass bands will try to find a hybrid in some way of that British tradition infused into a uniquely American style of music making.
So, Andrew, from your perspective, you're writing for the bands and you're obviously here and you're working with the Milwaukee Festival of Brass. What do you hear? What's the difference to your ears?
Between the two movements?
Yeah.
There's definitely a different sound concept. I think vibrato would be one thing. It's kind of the colouring of the sound. There's a different interpretation of that. Neither's right or wrong. It's just the tradition in that particular country. So that would be one thing. There's so many differences, really.
So when you're writing, are you writing with the British band in your ears, or are you writing specifically for a band if you're being commissioned?
It does depend if you're being commissioned. If there's a specific band in mind, you have a fair idea of the capabilities of the players and the sound of the players. If you're writing a piece that's more generic, that doesn't have a particular band in mind, that's a bit more of a different canvas, I think.
Have you two worked together before?
No, we haven't, actually.
This is our first project together.
So I'm very excited about it.
Well, I can't thank you both enough for coming in and educating me a little bit on the history of brass bands. Andrew and Mark, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mark Taylor is the director of the Milwaukee Festival Brass. Andrew Wainwright grew up in the Salvation Army brass band tradition in the UK. He now lives in Kenosha. Throughout the segment, we heard his arrangements for brass band.
The Milwaukee Festival Brass will perform its holiday concert Saturday evening at 7 at Pius High School on North 76th Street in Milwaukee. And that's all the time we have for Lake Effect today.
Coming up on the weekend edition of the show, rock star astrophysicist Neil deGrasse Tyson. If you missed him at his two sold-out Riverside Theater performances this week, here's a chance to hear the extended interview that we did with him on the science of knowing and the kind of space program that he'd have were he in charge.
And we'll also have Daniel Golden's picks for the best books to give as gifts this holiday season. The proprietor of Boswell Book Company takes us on his distinctively merry ride through his selections.
And on Monday's edition of the show, James Lowder joins us for his annual Games to Gift segment. Despite the fact we have not yet put up our holiday decorations in the Lake Effect bungalow, it's beginning to feel quite festive around here. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Lake Effect and Lake Effect Weekend come your way from listener-supported 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee.
Stay tuned. It's 11 o'clock. Fresh air comes your way next.